This is Neil Gaiman, author of a lot of things, actually. Sandman and American Gods and Neverwhere and Stardust and the Nancy Boys and many another thing. And you are listening to episode 57, the Heinz 57 Varieties episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
This is Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author Robert J. Sawyer.
And now, streaming from the Singularity Audio Studios in San Diego, California, your hosts. Welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This episode is brought to you by Bones Burnt Black, a science fiction thriller from Stephen Ewan Cobb, and by Reading the Wind, a hard SF tale of love and adventure that probes what it means to be human. My name is Sean Farrell, and Sam and I are decompressing from the insanity that is Comic-Con, so we're not together this week. She should be back next week. And we both had a really great time. You can visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for the coverage of the convention. Sam's going to get her experience to me soon, so I'll put it up on the story there. But if you go there now, you can read all about my Stargate Continuum red carpet premiere and drinking scotch with Tobias Bukel and signing CDs with Bear McCreary and all sorts of fun name-dropping type stuff. So come check it out. There's pictures over there, too. Yeah, you can't miss it. For now, though, we continue our coverage of the Clarion Workshop with celebrated author Neil Gaiman, who penned one of my favorite books, American Gods. I met with Neil in his hotel room, and even though both of us were exhausted, you know, him from teaching Clarion all week, and me from 2.5 days at Comic-Con, we both had a great time, I think. Well, I know I did. I won't speak for him. But my thanks to him and all of his Clarion instructors for allowing us to be a part of this, to be talking with them this summer, and to be participating in this small way. So I'm having a lot of fun, and I hope all of you are enjoying it as well. If you are an aspiring writer, you should think about applying to Clarion. The worst that can happen is you don't get in, right? So that's it for me up front here. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Neil Gaiman, and I'll see you on the other side. What if you got your heart's desire to fly a spaceship? What if you could go to the planet you've always dreamed of, where people like you came from, and where you were no longer considered a freak? My name is Joseph, and I got both of those dreams. Good dreams can turn to nightmares, and the future is not what we expect. On our approach to Silver's home, we were warned away. I had to find the resources to land safely, in spite of the fact I had never landed. The spaceport was closed, and the authorities might start shooting us as we defied them. And then I found a man in the ship's data, like myself, who could read the wind of data. And he had instructions to keep us from landing. Reading the Wind continues Brenda Cooper's saga of the Silver Ship. Visit the Five Worlds and return to Fremont. See what happens when multiple societies clash. Feel what it means to be human. Lose yourself in a story of suspense, love, and mind-blowing science fiction. Find Reading the Wind in bookstores everywhere and visit brenda-cooper.com to learn more about the novel and the author. All right, welcome back to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, and we're back for our fourth episode in the Clarion Special Series. Yes, I'm taking a break from Comic-Con. And I'm joined by Neil Gaiman, as you heard at the beginning, author of American Gods, one of my favorite books. And Neil, how's the week going?
It's been really good. It was a huge sort of surprise for me that I enjoyed it. I arrived here in a state of quivering terror, never having talked before, and convinced that they would realize this, sent my fear of like wolves onto a crippled elk. And actually what happened was I got out here and discovered that I was actually quite good at this and I really enjoyed it. They're an absolutely terrific bunch of students. So there's 18 of them, and I've been learning as much from them, I think, as they have from me.
So I didn't know this. You've never taught in workshops before or taught writing classes? Or
never taught anything before, no. I'm the kind of writer who writes. I make my living by writing books. That's what I do. That's how I do it. I was talking to some of the people from the university here, and they were saying, so you're up in Minneapolis, so are you teaching there? I'm saying, no, I'm not. I said, well, we thought you were a writer. I'm saying, yes, I'm a writer, and I'm a writer. I write the books. I've been asked to do Clarion for many, many years. For 6 or 7 years, I've been getting requests in what I teach Clarion. And for the first few years, I just said no, because I thought, well, I didn't know what I could teach.
Right.
And I thought, I felt very sort of like I'm still learning, and what have I got to tell anybody? And then last year, I thought, you know, this is starting to smack of some kind of horrible false modesty. I have all of these awards, and if I'm standing there going, well, I don't know, I have shelves with Hugos and Nebulas and such like
that.
So I said yes, and having said yes, I thought, good, I have discharged my moral obligation there. They've been asking me to do Clarion for 5 or 6 years, and I have finally said yes. At which point the people at Clarion West said, actually, it was us that's been asking you for 5 or 6 years. They just asked you once, and you said yes to them. I had failed to realize there was a...
So you got yourself in trouble.
Everybody was very understanding.
It seems fairly rare that an author who is consistently on the top of the New York Times bestseller list teaches, because as you say, there's a lot of time demands, and got a lot of projects. So now that you've done it once, is it going to be something that you want to do more often?
I don't know. I really enjoyed it. And I also found it every bit as frustrating because I'm only here for a week and they're like my babies. I'm going to have to give them up now to Jeff Ryman and Nalo. And I know that whatever I do for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be wanting to get online so I can see the stories they put up.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, I would love... I love what Jeff and Nala are doing, which is actually 2 weeks in residence, both of them here together, because they get a couple of weeks. There's that consistency, that through line. The university has already asked me if I'd like to come in and be a writer in residence here.
Okay.
Which I thought was astonishingly sweet of them, and I don't know, I might do at some point. I've never been a writer in residence before. And
what would your duties be as a writer in residence?
I believe I would be, half of it would just be, I'd be a writer in residence and I'd be writing, and I'd probably teach a course in something.
Right.
It's interesting, I really didn't think I knew very much, and then got to ask this lot what they wanted to know about. And the Clarionites thought and discussed amongst themselves, and they said, well, we'd like to know about writing comics, we'd like to know about story, and we'd like to know about writing the TV and movies. So I've done 2 group lectures so far, one on writing comics and one on just stories and what makes a story and what makes a story interesting and all of that kind of stuff. And tonight I'm going to give them a talk on writing for movies and TV.
Very cool. You know, I interviewed Dozell Young today, who's been a friend of mine for a couple of years now, comic book writer.
Yeah.
And
gentleman.
Yeah, he's a very good guy. He's coming out in an anthology this week. We were talking a little bit about the differences between writing in prose and writing in comics. So what were some of the things that you shared with the students that's different in when you're writing for comics versus short stories or novels?
Well, a short story or a novel, you have no control over the reading experience. You can write the best possible story that you can, but at the point where it's desperately important to you to describe the castle they're riding towards, it's you have no control over whether or not the reader reads the first 2 lines and then goes, oh, I get it, okay, it's a castle they're riding towards, it where's the next bit of dialogue, and their eye skips down and they carry on.
Right.
In comics, you do have control. you have control over pretty much every word that is read, every image that they see. You have control over when somebody turns the page and what they see when they turn the page. Now, what you don't have is the kind of freedom that you have in prose to build things in somebody's head. You can hide things in prose. You could hide skin color. You could hide gender, for example. You could absolutely write a story in which you simply don't know the gender of the lead character. Mm-hmm. You can have a first-person narration, so he's saying I, and never reveal the gender of the person in the entire novel. And it's quite fair, and it might make the person reading it reassess their attitude to gender, and they might think, okay, well, it's interesting. And some people may just assume that it's a boy, and some people might assume it's a girl. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could do that as easily in a comic, because you can see the person.
Right.
Having said that, one of the strengths is that you can see the person. You can do something you cannot do anywhere in prose, which is silent panels. Mm-hmm. Which is, I love silent panels. I love that beat where you just, you know, somebody says something and the other person just get one panel where the Sandman and Delirium are just staring at each other or whatever. And it's lovely. In prose, you can't do it. You can't not say anything, because the moment you say, nobody said anything, you just said something.
You just have to put a blank page in there.
Well, it's been tried. You know, there's this, looks like Tristram Shandy, where all sorts of typographical experiments were tried. Yeah. And people have been trying ever since. But the truth is, these are things that comics are incredibly good at, that prose is very bad at. And there are things that prose is great at that comics really can't do. It's fun. That's the joy, you know, it's the joy of media. Radio is not dance. Movies are not poems. I love the fact that we have all these different things, and you can do different things with all of them.
Do you have one medium or media that you prefer to write for, or do you enjoy all of them equally?
I love radio plays. Don't get to do them much in America anymore. So I every now and then, every few years, I'll try and do a radio play for the BBC, just because it's really fun.
What aspects of the radio play causes it to jump to the top of your list there?
They're kind of like movies, only they're cheaper, and the pictures in your head can be significantly better than the pictures you get in most movies. Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there's a line in there where Arthur Dent says, turns to Ford Prefect while they're going through the infinite improbability drive and says, Ford, you're turning into an infinite number of penguins. Which, in my head, when I heard it, was the coolest scene in the entire world, and still remains one of the coolest scenes in the entire world. And when they tried it on TV, it was pathetic. Mm-hmm. And when they tried it in the movies, they didn't even try it. They turned everybody into a ball of yarn.
Right.
And made more yarn people. Radio can turn somebody into an infinite number of penguins. The pictures in your head are better. And it can also do it... If you want a long shot in movies, you have to unpack all your lights and unpack all your cameras and put everybody away. Mm-hmm. And then set up the cameras 500 feet away and make sure all of the crew are out of shot. Mm-hmm. And relight it. And put everybody back in, and 4 hours later, you're ready to go for your shot. For radio plays, if you want to indicate that you've moved a long way away, just get the person to take a step back from the microphone.
Yeah.
And you can have all of the fun of making a movie in a weekend.
Yeah. I do some film work here, and when I'm working on a film, that's what it is. I spend 4 or 5 hours waiting in between pages just to shoot a page's worth of dialogue.
Yeah.
And even just going from mids to close-ups can take half an hour, especially if you're outside.
Exactly. And it takes no time at all for radio plays. Yeah. Just one reason I love radio plays.
Well, when you were first getting started, did you attend any workshops yourself?
When I was first getting started, I actually had heard about Clarion and wanted to do Clarion, but there wasn't a Clarion in England. Although we have an English guy here today, which is kind of cool. I did Milford, and the original Milford Writers' Workshops were founded by James Blish in Milford, Pennsylvania, I believe. And then when Blish moved to England, he set up the English Milfords at Milford-on-Sea, a little English town. And I went to Milford in 1985 and Milford in 1986.
Very cool.
Learned with people who were... And Milford was for professional writers to get better. And I'd had a couple of professional sales. And there were people there like John Clute, Bruce Sterling, Gwyneth Jones, Rachel Pollock, Lisa Tuttle, Richard Cowper, Diana Wynne Jones, Gary Kilworth.
Wow.
Mary Gentle, you know, an astonishingly fine collection of writers. And the first year, I didn't think I was learning anything about writing. I thought I was learning about reading. And then I discovered that actually you cannot learn about reading without having learned about writing.
So who were the teachers of this fine group?
What was great was everybody was the teacher. It was round table. Everybody brought a manuscript. Every manuscript got read. Every manuscript, you know, we do two a day, maybe three a day. And the rest of the time was spent in reading or in playing silly literary games or talking about grand things that we wanted to do. I remember talking to Scott Baker, an American writer, about this idea that I had for a book that I thought I was going to call the Graveyard Book, about a little boy who was whose family were killed and who took refuge in a graveyard and was brought up by dead people. And that would have been like end of summer, September 1985. So.
And now, what a great transition. Let's move into that. Now, 2008... forthcoming in September, the Graveyard Book.
23 years later.
Yeah. Have you been working on it at all during that time, or has it just been living in your head?
It mostly has been living in my head. Every now and again, I would try writing the first page, and I would glare at it, and it wouldn't be very good, and I'd put it away and think, okay, I'll get back to it one day. And I'll get back to it when I'm better. I thought, you know, I need to be a better writer for this. And then there came a point in there where I thought, you know, I'm not getting any better. I'm as good as I'm going to be.
As I say, you've had a number of successful books at this point. What was so challenging? What was the challenge it was giving you?
Well, for the first 10 or 15 years, it was just, I knew it was a really, really good idea. And I didn't know that I was up to it. And I wanted to be at the top of my game.
Yeah,
it's that thing where you go, didn't want to sell the idea short. And there were definitely long periods in there where I thought, you know, I'm never going to write it. And there were periods where I felt like the idea had actually gone cold. Happy to say it warmed up again.
Now, I don't know what the YA market was like 23 years ago. I don't know if it was as vibrant as it is now. Did you always intend for it to be for middle-aged readers? Or is that something that developed as the market developed?
I honestly have no idea who it's for. In England, they're publishing it both as a children's book and as an adult book.
Okay.
Two different ISBNs. And
really?
Yeah.
Two different covers,
two different illustrators, same words.
I've never heard of that being done before.
It's certainly very rare, if it has been done before. But I wasn't sure what kind of book it was. I don't think they were either. It seems to... We thought I was writing a kid's book, and then it seems to work incredibly well for adults. So I hope both kinds of people like it.
Well, do you approach a book differently if you are intentionally writing it for a younger market than you do an adult novel? What are the challenges
there?
Yeah,
you do. You assume your readers are much, much smarter and reading more closely.
For the...
children's market.
For the middle,
I will, if I'm writing for adults, I will assume they're a little bit dim.
Really?
And other things are going on, and they have emails, and they probably had a bad day that morning, and their boss was nasty to them, and they're a bit distracted.
Yeah.
With kids, I will assume you are incredibly bright, you are reading every word, you're giving me your full attention, and probably if you really like this book, maybe next month you'll read it again. So kids' books, I will work harder, and assume my readers are going to work harder.
That's fascinating. I've never heard that before from an author who writes both, but I see where you get that. Neil, if you were going to write a science fiction novel, what would you write?
I don't know. I'd love to write. When I was growing up, I was sure I would be a science fiction author. If you'd have said, what will you be when you grow up? Yeah, I wanted to be Larry Niven.
Oh, really?
I thought I was going to write hard science. The fact that I wasn't actually terribly interested in hard science was something that I figured that would happen. That would come in time. Mm-hmm. I would suddenly develop a passion for and a delight in theoretical physics about the same time that my testicles dropped, probably. and my voice dropped, and I grew hair in interesting places. And it didn't happen. I eventually grew up and found that I was a fantasy author. I really wasn't a science fiction author. I don't know. I've always loved the idea of writing a space opera. Just because I think space opera is such a glorious genre of books.
Who are some of your favorite space opera? I'm not interrupting here. But who are some of your favorite authors of space opera?
Well, when I was a kid, when I was 11, it was E. E. Doc Smith. I think every 11-year-old who's interested in science fiction should read E. Doc Smith, because all of the things that Smith is really, really bad at and has no interest in, like human relations and girls and stuff, is stuff that 11-year-old boys have no interest at all in. And what you're interested in is the cool stuff, is that you've got the lenses and they zoom around the galaxy and there are the evil Edorians and the good Arisians, both as secret masters of the universe behind the scenes, and all of that stuff is just so much fun. And basically, it's just the Green Lantern Corps. Yeah. I mean, the Lensman series is what Julie Schwartz happily and enthusiastically ripped off when he sat down to revive Green Lantern and create the Silver Age one.
Do you still read it currently, space opera?
No.
So you probably don't have much time for reading at all, I would imagine.
Partly I don't have much time for reading. And partly, about 15, 16 years ago, I was a judge for 2 years running for the Arthur C. Clarke Awards, which is an English award that is awarded to the best work of science fiction published in England that year. And the judges are expected to read every single work of SF published in England, in the UK rather, over a year. And I did the first year, and that was about okay. But I think I should have stopped there. Because by the second year, it was like aversion therapy. I really, being forced to read everything, no matter how bad, published in the UK over a year, for 2 years, by the end, I really didn't want to read any more science fiction. And it would take special cases. I would go back for people like Colin Greenland and Ian M. Banks and Gene Wolfe, but nowhere near the absolute unthinking enthusiasm and love for SF that I had before I was an Arthur C. Clarke Award judge.
Huh. Were you talking like 40, 50 books a year?
No, you're talking every single book published in the UK.
So that's...
Yeah, across... You probably had 40 publishers altogether. You had...
So including...
It included American reprints,
books
from Europe or whatever that were published, it included all UK books. There were many, many hundreds of books. I think in my first year, Colin Greenland won for Take Back Plenty, and in my second year, it was a tie between a Pat Cadigan book and an Ian M. Banks book.
Yeah, that would do it. I'd be tired of reading whatever genre it was after that many titles in such a short time. Well, you mentioned you are a fantasy writer, and anyone who's read your work recognizes the fantasy elements, but you're not branded or ghettoized by the mainstream as a fantasy writer like so many fantasy writers are. Why is it?
Luck and packaging. I guess, and also because what I tend to write, with perhaps the exception of Stardust, which is, you know, which is a fairy tale, a classic fairy tale, tend to be books that have at least one foot in this world.
Right.
They aren't. Most of my books are American Gods or Nancy Boys or Neverwhere, at least recognizable as being sort of part of this world, even if it's a rather delirious version of this world, or a heightened version of this world, or a world in which metaphors are roaming freely.
So you think that gives a wider breadth of readers something to grab onto that you're not going to get in an epic fantasy with dwarves and orcs and obvious.
I don't know. I don't think about it. I don't like epic fantasies with dwarves and orcs. And I think they sell very well and people love them, but that's not what I do.
Yeah. Who are some of your favorite writers in the field working today?
Gene Wolfe, Jonathan Carroll, Eddie Campbell, Margot Lanigan, astonishing Australian writer.
Yeah, I met her a couple of years ago, and she's a lot of fun. She's cool.
Samuel R. Delaney, Nalo Hopkinson. I've just been given a Roger Zelazny novel from, I think, the late 60s or perhaps very, very early 70s that was never published, that was found in his papers, called The Dead Man's Brother, which is going to be published later this year. And that's my comfort reading. And I'm trying to read it as slowly as I can, so I'm allowing myself like a chapter every 2 or 3 weeks. Because I know that when this is done, I won't have any more, there won't be any more suddenly discovered Roger Zelazny books in his papers, but I loved Zelazny. The late Tom Dish was an astonishing short story writer, and I quite liked his novels. I suppose The Businessman in particular I enjoyed, but I loved his short stories. Kelly Link, who was teaching here.
Yeah.
Jeff Ryman, who is teaching here, is far away one of my favorite authors, as is Susanna Clarke. I could go on forever. We're incredibly fortunate being in a world that's filled with magical authors, living and dead. Harlan Ellison.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I love Harlan, and he's a good writer. You look at some of the great Harlan Ellison stories. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream is a little tour de force. And there's a bunch of stories. Some of them I think I like better than he does. There's one called The Time of the Eye, which is so nasty and so dark.
Is that a novel or a short story?
Short story.
Short story. When you're looking at younger writers, or I should say younger not based on age, but based on how long they've been publishing, are there any that have caught your eye in the last few years that you think, hey, this guy or gal is going to be big in a few years?
Well, the trouble is that the biggest problem with something like that is the moment that you start saying people, you start sounding like you're either patronizing or completely out of it. Because you say, well, so-and-so, and everyone listening to them, they're a younger writer. What do you mean they're a younger writer? They just, you know, I'm thinking, well, I should mention Tim Pratt. And I go, well, I probably shouldn't mention Tim Pratt. He's not really a younger writer. He beat me for the Hugo Award last year. That's sort of like how incredibly ridiculous would it be being to say, well, Tim Pratt's a great young writer. So honestly, I don't know. I think the young writers I'm most excited about are the 18 of them here at Clarion. They're astonishingly good. Some of them are, you know, there's a few of them who I think are already ready for the big time. And there are some of them who are going to be ready for the big time in 2 or 3 years. There are some who it may be 5 years from now. But some of them who are basically ready to go and get contracts with publishers and get down to work. And some of them who are going to need to write some novels and some short stories. But it's really fun. They're so bright.
Last question for you. And thank you for making time for this on the end of the week.
I'm sure you're feeling it.
We do have a lot of aspiring writers listening to the show. What advice would you have for them as they are working towards their goal of being professionally published?
Honestly, the most important advice I have for them is the most important advice that I have for about half of Clarion, which is you got to write. And the way that you get better is by writing. And it's much, much better to go off and write 10,000 words filled with glorious mistakes than to think for 3 weeks and then to write a 1,500-word little jewel and then polish that jewel for the next month or two until it glows and you have one perfect little thing. And yeah. While somebody else has written 30,000 words that probably doesn't have anything usable in it, but is 30,000 words better now?
Right.
And they've made 30,000 words worth of cool mistakes they won't be making again. Also, it's really important, one thing that I'm starting to find with these new guys, is in a world in which a computer is also an entertainment machine mm-hmm. that plugs you into the sum totality of human knowledge mm-hmm. and you can play Spider Solitaire on it as well.
At the same time.
At the same time. Finding strategies that allow you to write are incredibly important, and that may just be something like turning off the internet mm-hmm. and it may be something like going and buying a notebook and a pen and going and finding a shady spot and sitting and doing your writing there.
Or for the folks like me, getting a babysitter.
There are lots and lots of ways to do it, but the important thing is that you get the writing done.
There's a Ray Bradbury who said that quantity over quality.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the thing that Ray Bradbury actually said that I think is just that I quote is he said, you know, you've got 1,000,000 words of shit in you, and you've got to get them down on the page mm-hmm. before you get to the good stuff. And while you could hope that there's going to be some good stuff in that first 1,000,000 words, there probably will be, it's really, really useful just to write. And nobody ever won a Hugo Award by thinking about a book that they were one day going to write.
Mm-hmm. Well, Neil, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Sean.
And folks, hang in there. We'll be right back.
In space, spinning out of control, and on a collision course with the sun, the crew of the spacecraft Corvus is about to discover something that will shatter everything they hold dear, and call into question everyone they trust. Murder. From Stephen Ewan Cobb, Parsec Award-winning producer of the Future and You podcast, comes a science fiction thriller that will make you question everything. Find Bones Burnt Black at your favorite online retailer or at your local bookstore. And visit the author's website at stevecobb.com. Bones Burnt Black by Stephen Ewan Cobb. If space doesn't kill you, someone you trust will. Thank you again, Neil, for joining us. I had a wonderful time chatting with him for half an hour or so, and I hope I can do it again someday. Now, even though Sam is not here, let's go ahead and get to some feedback before we wrap this one up. I'll save some of the feedback for when she is here, though, since it's directed to her. But you guys and gals have been really responsive lately, so I want to get some of these into the show. My sincere thanks, by the way, to everyone who wrote in about the Amazon issue. If you're new to the show, then just listen to the first part of episode 56, and you'll know what I'm talking about. It seems that most of you agree with me that Amazon has crossed the line on more than one occasion, probably, and several of you have recommended alternate avenues to having affiliate links on the website. I'm going to check that out, but I'm going to spend some time on this and really go through my options. I want to get it right the first time. I don't want to have to change again in another 6 months. And I need something that has the versatility that will really give us the support we need. You know, I want you guys to be able to come and look at the books on the site and get a lot of information. And if you want to buy them, be able to buy them really easily from a source you can trust. So hopefully by the end of August, we'll have a new system in place. Okay, so some emails here. John writes about an older episode in which I discussed looking for a writer's group. He was wondering if I ever found one, and the answer is no, but I do have several first readers now, all of whom who are professionally published. That's not the same as a writer's group, but it's very helpful, extremely helpful. John also mentions the online group Critters, but he's not sure if online groups are as efficient as ones you actually attend. Well, John, I have very little experience with online groups, so I can only share my opinion. And personally, I don't like putting my work out on the internet for a faceless person I've never met to critique. I like to know who is critiquing my work. I want to know a little bit about their personality. I want to know their tastes. I want to know what they've had published. And if they haven't been published, then I'm not all that interested in having them read my stuff. They could be great. You know, I could be cutting myself off from the best feedback out there. But the proven commodity is having someone who's achieved more than you have look at your work. That's where I've found that feedback is most helpful. It's from people who are a couple steps ahead of me. And the best way to judge that is, are you published? It helps me to analyze the quality of their feedback that way. So online groups aren't for me, even though I know there's some good ones out there and I've heard good things about Critters. But hey, John, maybe you should check it out. You know, look around. John also asked about having a critique community on the Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing website with message boards where writers could come in and post their work and be critiqued. And it's an interesting idea. I know I'm not ready to go there right now, but it's a very interesting idea. And I'll certainly put that in my potential growth applications as the website and the podcast continues to grow. So thanks for that, John. We'll see. Roxanne from France writes, and she last sent an email before Sam joined the show, so it's been a while. And she first says that she loves how the show has grown over the last year or so. Thank you, Roxanne. I really appreciate that. She also comments on the Amazon situation, pointed out that Amazon has a truly unfair advantage in France because of the Lang Law, which prevents bookstores from selling books at anything other than the cover price. This makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for bookstores to compete with the online giant. Roxanne was also grateful to have Marianne Mohanraj on the show. She said, let me quote a little bit from the email here. She and all those who are fighting for more diversity in the genre are heroes of mine. I think diversity and questions of identity is a fundamental subject you needed to address in the show sooner or later. I can't wait for the Nalo Hopkinson show. I'm sure it will be equally fascinating in that regard. I'm having troubles introducing those questions in the French genre community. My professional goal is to work in the publishing industry, and I really hope I will be able to participate in changing this by making sure the authors who address those issues will be published or translated in France. Well, thank you, Roxanne. I agree. It's a topic that will be addressed in one of the Comic-Con episodes as well, and we'll continue to bring it up in future shows, as well as any other topic that is important to the genre. There's so much to cover, it's hard to do it in 3 or 4 shows a month. Okay, I have some more emails here, but we're going to save them for next time. I want to get Sam in on them. We've got a lot of comments on the episode 56 page, again, regarding Amazon. So if you have an opinion, please drop by and leave it there. I would love more feedback and more ideas about how I can switch out the affiliate information that's on the website. Also, if you went to Comic-Con this year, please leave a comment with a highlight of your experience to the Comic-Con page. You can't miss it. It's a feature page on the front of the website. You'll see a picture there of Ben Browder and Richard Dean Anderson. Just click on their heads and it'll open up the story for you. But I'd love to get a collection of different Comic-Con experiences. from the listeners. I didn't meet any listeners there, but I know there were a couple of you there. So send them in. We'll put them up, and it'll be a lot of fun, I think. That is going to do it for this episode. No extra segments this time. You can email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com, and you can call that voicemail line at 206-350-5029 to leave comments or questions. And, of course, visit the website, adventuresinscifipublishing.com. Got more content going up. I'm getting into the habit of adding something every day. If you are not subscribed to the show's new feed, please use the subscribe to iTunes link on the homepage. I'm trying to get as many people to subscribe through that link as possible, because the more folks we have subscribe through iTunes that way, the more likely it is we'll get featured in the iTunes store. And I just think that would be cool. I'm a little vain, I admit it. Lots of interviews coming this month, including Nello Hopkinson, Jeff Ryman, Michael Shanks, Amanda Tapping, Ben Browder, assuming my audio is going to be workable, we'll see, Lilith St. Crow, Eldon Thompson, and many, many more. Lots of stuff from Comic-Con. So, thank you very much for listening. Until next week, keep reading. Music for Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing by Cargo Cult, from their song Dirt. You can learn more about them at magmatune.com. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.